फ्रेंड्स, द लास्ट सब हेडिंग ऑफ दिस चैप्टर ग्रीक क्रिटिसिज्म ऑफ एरिस्टोटल इज एरिस्टोटल्स इन्फ्लुएंस वैल्यू ऑफ द पोएटिक्स. द फर्स्ट सब हेडिंग इज अ ग्रेट वर्ल्ड बुक. द पोएटिक्स इज नॉट ओनली द फर्स्ट थ्रूली फिलोसॉफिकल डिस्कशन ऑफ लिटरेचर बट द फाउंडेशन ऑफ ऑल सब्सिक्वेंट डिस्कशंस. It is an exposition of the principles of literary criticism as valid for Shakespeare and Milton as it was for Homer and Sophocles. It is one of those world books which enjoy a worldwide popularity and whose influence and fascination is perennial. Then the other subheading is brief history. It was written about the year 330 BC and was widely acclaimed. Then it suffered a temporary eclipse in later Greek and Latin literature. Although there are traces of its influence, we do not hear much of it. In the Middle Ages, it was known and amply misunderstood by Syrian and Arabic scholars. Its modern life begins in Renaissance Italy at the end of 15th century. Since then, it has been translated and edited and annotated in every century and in many languages, attaining at times an authority of a holy writ, the doctrines of which were received with more reverence than understanding. It is still alive because it is a study of a great art by a peculiarly acute, learned, and methodical critic. It is the first book of literary criticism, and it is written by the world's first scientist. It is the statement of Hamilton Fyfe, F-Y-F-E. Then causes of its influence. The continuing influence and prestige of the poetics results from its many merits. First, it is a comprehensive treatment of poetry, its nature and art, purely on aesthetic grounds. Second, it reveals many of the first principles of poetry and drama. Third, it is a valuable study of critical methods, practical criticism, and not mere generalized statements. It is a mine of suggestive ideas. It is thought-provoking in the extreme. It is one of the few pieces of systematic criticism that have come down to us from ancients. Sixth, it is a great contribution to literary theory, to the examination of the nature and function of poetry. And seventh, it is the first book to expound historical and psychological methods of criticism. The other subheading is its practical nature. The aim of poetics is a practical one. It is a textbook of practical instruction and guidance, immensely useful for would-be poets and dramatists. It tells us clearly what to seek and what to avoid in the construction of a drama, what is the real aim of drama, and how the achievements of that aim determines the structure of that drama. It tells us the ways and means by which the aim of drama can be achieved, and what are the difficulties and obstacles in the way, and how they are to be avoided. It is a comprehensive treatise on the art of writing plays, and show invaluable for those who want initiation into the mysteries of the craft. Further, the work is a great irritant to thought. The defense of poetry which Aristotle makes in Poetics, has always been used by those who have sought to justify poetry and defend it against puritanical attacks, as in Renaissance England. Sir Philip Sidney's apology for poetry is based entirely on Aristotle's defense. Aristotle's theory regarding the nature of poetic imitation and the peculiar pleasure of tragedy has been the basis of all subsequent discussions of these topics up to date. The other subheading is Aristotle's achievement as a critic. It may be going to an extreme to say with Lessing that the critic of literature, Aristotle, is as infallible as the elements of Euclid. And even Euclid is outmoded now, but we may justifiably echo the saying of Sainsbury, the historian of criticism, that it is impossible for anyone who undertakes the office of a critic to omit the study of Aristotle without very great harm. Even he sounds like an exaggeration, but it is true, because Aristotle, with the certain perspicacity, perspicacity, with a plain perspicacity of common sense, discovers that fundamental principles of dramatic art, which neither critics nor dramatists can neglect without becoming irrelevant and ineffective. Aristotle's exposition of the various topics in the Poetics may be bold and unemotional. It may avoid the deeper issues, it may infuriate poets and those to whose emotions poetry makes a powerful appeal, but it is true as far as it goes, and as sound as careful observation and analysis can make it. Aristotle's attitude is cool, objective attitude of the scientist, who, while dissecting a frog, is rightly blind to its exotic beauty. Aristotle is the first scientific critic. He successfully achieved almost all that criticism can achieve on inductive principles by observation, analysis, classification, and generalization. The limited vision of his rather dogmatic common sense, he is the father of all academic dons, may seem often inadequate and sometimes irritating, but as Sainsbury says in his History of Criticism, although in literary criticism we have advanced at some points to further positions, over most of the ground we are still engaged in consolidating the territory which Aristotle occupied. Any readers who wish to check up on Aristotle's views and to understand them more clearly should take them singly and apply them to examples taken from ancient and modern literature. They would find it a pleasant and profitable recreation. They would thus realize the validity and universality of Aristotle's views. His influence. Ever since the Renaissance, literary criticism in Europe has centered around the Poetics. Its influence has not always been healthy, but it has provoked thought and discussion, and thus has directed literary criticism and helped to clarify literary concepts. It has suggested possible ways of study and inquiry. To its early commentators, the Poetics did not appear a revolutionary document or even one significantly at variance with established doctrine, they conceived of it not as threatening, but as illuminating, clarifying, and in fact substantiating such doctrine, and such importance as they accorded it was a part of that doctrine. Its doctrines were accordingly blended into the general synthesis which had survived antiquity and the Middle Ages, a synthesis of elements gathered from Plato, Horace, Quintilian, and its original role in that synthesis was not a principal but a subordinate one. What Aristotle himself might have meant was to the first interpreters of the Poetics of less concern than the light he could shed on the meaning of others, of Horace in particular. Thus, from the beginning, the Poetics was fitted into a context from which, even in the period of its greatest authority, it was not to escape when it ceased to be a commentary upon Horace. The Ars Poetica became a commentary upon it. From the beginning, too, it was regarded as an arrangement of dicta rather than as a scientific treatise resulting from the application of a particular philosophic method to a particular subject matter. In consequence, statements could be interpreted beyond Aristotle's meaning to produce doctrines such as that of the three unities and inferences, which Aristotle would not have sanctioned, could be drawn to provide such theories as those of moral purgation, or to raise problems that Aristotle would have thought irrelevant to Poetics, such as whether purgation was allopathic or homeopathic. More importantly, Aristotelian doctrines, isolated from their supporting arguments, could be reordered in sequences which frequently converted premise into conclusion, or conclusion into premise, or both into a mere succession of dicta, and defense as well as attack turned on such arguments as learning or ingenuity might provide, quite independently of their relevance to Aristotelian principles and method. Moreover, the cryptic brevity of Aristotle's style invited commentary, as the corrupt condition of the texts demanded it, and it was only natural, in view of the difficulties that both presented, that in general Aristotle could have been confused with his commentators, and that notions of the Aristotelian Poetics should have been drawn from the latter rather than from the former. Out of various misinterpretations and understandings of the Poetics was formed the complex notions and rules which constitute pseudo-classicism and which influenced the entire course of English literary history during the 17th and 18th centuries. The authority of Aristotle was now second only that of Bible, and to disagree with Aristotle was a sacrilege and blasphemy. Sacrilege, S-A-C-R-I-L-E-G-E, and a blasphemy, B-L-A-S-P-H-E-M-Y. It was in the early 18th century that the hold of the so-called Aristotelian rulers was most rigid. Ever since the Renaissance, Aristotle was wielded great authority as is clear from the pronouncements of Sir Philip Sidney, Ben Jonson, and many others, but it was in the early 18th century that his influence and authority reached its zenith. The loosening of the grip of pseudo-Aristotelianism came with Dr. Johnson's famous vindication of Shakespeare's mingling of the tragedy and the comedy, of the serious and the gay, and his violations of the three unities. With the dawn of Romanticism, attention has been focused more and more on the text of poetics. Its many merits have been recognized and its shortcomings have been freely acknowledged. The last subheading of this chapter is The Poetics Today. Even today, the poetics continues to be studied and prescribed as textbook in schools and colleges all over the world, from California to Calcutta. It is the statement of F.E. Lukács. This is so because Aristotle has formulated once for all the great first principles of dramatic art, the canons of dramatic logic, which a dramatist can ignore only at his peril. T.S. Eliot is right when he calls Aristotle a man of universal intelligence, that is, one who could apply his intelligence to anything. The ordinary intelligence, however brilliant, is good only for certain classes of subjects. With Aristotle, the case was different. In whatever sphere he worked, he looked solely and steadfastly at the object. In his short and broken treatise, he provides an extended example, not of laws or even of method, for there is no method except to the very intelligent, but of intelligence itself swiftly operating upon the analysis of sensation to the point of principle and definition. A truer understanding of the poetics has done away with the blind idolatry, but it has also resulted in a better appreciation of the real value and significance of his epoch-making work. And friends, in this way we come to the end of this whole chapter, that is the Greek criticism of Aristotle. Thanks.